Hey there, welcome to the Creative Classroom Podcast. I'm your host, John Spencer. I am a former middle school teacher, current college professor, and I am passionate about seeing teachers transform their classrooms into bastions of creativity and wonder. And so on this podcast, I share ideas and strategies. I talk about things that worked, but also those big epic fails that I've made along the way and what I learned from that. And one of the things I also do is interview experts, which is what today's podcast is going to be. And the reason we do all of this is because I ultimately believe that teachers play a profound role in helping students reach their creative potential. And today I'm talking to an expert named Katie Novak, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. So Dr. Katie Novak is an internationally renowned education consultant, author, graduate instructor at the University of Pennsylvania, and a former assistant superintendent of schools in Massachusetts. With 20 years of experience in teaching and administration, an earned doctorate in curriculum and teaching, and 12 published books, Katie designs and presents workshops both nationally and internationally, focusing on the implementation of inclusive practices, especially in this zone of universal design for learning, which is what she's going to be talking about today, as well as the multi-tiered systems of support. She'll get into that as well. And universally designed leadership. Novak's work has impacted educators worldwide as her contributions and collaborations have built upon the foundation for an educational framework that is critical for student success. So without further ado, here is Katie Novak. All right, we have with us here Dr. Katie Novak, and I'm really excited about having you on this podcast. I've been following your work, reading your books for a while, and it's an honor to have you on here.
I feel the same exact way. I'm super excited to talk. I'm always sharing your work with all of my colleagues, so this is going to be awesome.
So when I think about UDL, like, you're the first name that comes to mind for me. I mean, there are different theorists, different researchers, different people in the field who've been doing it for a long time. But for me, I've been struck by the fact that you make UDL practical and accessible for teachers. And so I'm curious, your own journey, how did you get into universal design for learning?
So I actually learned about UDL when I was a teacher, and I've always had this teacher perspective of what this has meant. So when I was a seventh grade English teacher, this was more than 15 years ago, I was in a district that received a grant to get really intensive training in universal design for learning for a group of teachers, because we were guinea pigs in a study called The Tale of Four Districts. So we got to work really, really closely with the founders of an organization called CAST. They created Universal Design for Learning. And what was so funny about how I got into sharing more about it is because we were a huge part of this research study, they were in our classrooms like once a month, and they were interviewing us all the time to really try to figure out what does it take to kind of grow and scale these practices and shift the culture and climate of the way that we design in a school. And after a particular session where we were getting professional development, they asked us to fill out a survey, and we had focus groups. And I said something like, you know what, this would be so much better if you universally designed it. And I wasn't trying to be fresh. They were just like, you know, this is about voice, like what would be more helpful for you? And I said, I mean, I'm all in, but like, we're all doing the same activities. We're all on the same pace. Like, it just feels a little discrepant from what we're trying to do. And the founder of CAST, his name is David Rose, Dr. David Rose, who's like such a mentor to me. He was like, well, how would you do it? And the rest is history. So he invited me to the Harvard University UDL Institute. It was the first time I presented in front of adults. And I came in with like a laundry basket full of salsa ingredients. And I'm like, I'm going to do a traditional lesson on how to make salsa. And then I'm going to do like a UDL lesson. And everyone's going to like create their own goals, make their own recipe, work a lot, right? It was bananas, right? And I'm having like a wonderful old time with like heads of school and universities and, you know, superintendents. And I was done being like, yeah, well, that was fun. And people are like, oh, can you come to my district? I'm like, for what? Right? Like I teach seventh grade. So it kind of spun from there. And I've really, really tried, even when I went into administration, when I start working in graduate schools, now that I'm doing a lot of consulting, is I never want to lose that like teacher's passion for modeling. What do we want classrooms to be like? So I am in awe of all of the people who do the research and create the literature. But then I like to look at it and say, how do we deliver this in a way that really models the type of learning we want to see.
I'm curious, early on in your teacher journey, as you were embracing this whole idea of universal design, what were some paradigm shifts you had to make or mindset shifts along the way?
I mean, the biggest thing was just releasing myself from this one size fits all, that I think that we have been kind of led to believe that there is a way to teach that is better than other ways, and that there are strategies that all students should follow. And, you know, there are ways that students should share what they know. And that just becomes kind of the collective bias that we pass down from generation to generation of teachers. So if we had a standard like we want all students to create a model to explain, you know, how gravity works or something like that, it's like, well, you're going to learn about gravity from this textbook. You're going to take a multiple choice test, and then you're going to create this model, you know, by hand. That excludes so many learners, right? Text excludes anyone, if it's printed, who doesn't speak English, who doesn't decode at grade level, who is visually impaired. Like there's so many barriers like within that text. And then even if we want students to create a model, like why not put them in a makerspace and give them access to digital tools and be like, be innovative, like do this your way, create a model. And when you're done with it at a formative level, allow me to provide some feedback and then like we'll rework it and let's go through this problem of practice together. And I think that letting go of we're all going to read this text, we're all going to take this quiz, we're all going to make a model using these materials was so hard. And I certainly didn't do it all at once. But as I began to let go of some of these, we're all going to do this in the same way practices, I actually saw engagement increase, classroom management became much easier, and learning really started to excel. So I was like, well, there's something here, like this is results oriented. And I'm enjoying this journey so much more than just being up on stage essentially all the time. So I think that the hardest thing is just recognizing that the ways that we have been taught to teach are a way, but it's not the way.
You know, it's interesting. My own journey in empowering students was like layers of adding more voice and choice. You know, it started with letting them choose topics and then, you know, doing projects and then a place where I would encourage them to engage in self-assessment, peer assessment, own the assessment process. And, you know, it was this journey of asking, you know, what are we doing for students that they could be doing for themselves, right? And yet, for some reason, there was one key area that was the last for me, and it was probably year six of teaching. And what happened was I had a very student-centered classroom, but I, for the first time ever, had a co-teacher, and I was not used to that, right? I was now teaching self-contained. I was teaching... Every student in my class was either gifted, special education, or ELL, right? So they're either learners with exceptionalities, they're English learners, or they're gifted tag. Right? They're, and many of them are multiple. And so given that reality, I had this very project-based student-centered classroom. And yet, there was a moment where I told a student, don't use sentence stems. And the special ed teacher I was with said, wait, we've got to undo this for a second. What's going on here? Why did you tell someone not to use a support? And I said, well, it's not designed for him. And this teacher said, when was the last time you used a curb cut? And I was like, what's a curb cut? She explains what it is. And I was like, oh, all the time. At the time my kids were little, I was like, for a stroller. And you know, what about closed caption? What about this? What about that? And so we redesigned what we did, so instead of polling small groups, we had workshops and anyone could opt into the workshop. And we made a class rule that at some point, every student needs to ask for help. Every student needs to go to a workshop at least once. And it was really interesting because what I noticed was once they could self-select scaffolds and supports, right? Then the fear was gone. It was more inclusive. Everybody was, there wasn't these are the gifted kids. These are the ELLs. It was much more, we're a classroom community and we're all going to get the supports that we need. And I know UDL is much bigger than just self-selecting scaffolds, but for me, that was a big mindset shift to make everything available to all students.
Yeah. I always say, like, what is necessary for one student will be made available for all of them. And sometimes I'll even have everyone do a no thank you bite. So that's what I would call it. Like, you know, we're going to produce writing, right? Writing is actually the goal. We're all going to produce writing. We want that writing to be authentic. We want it to be meaningful. We want it to be to an audience bigger than me, bigger than this class. But ultimately, we're going to be producing writing. So let's talk about all the different tools that you can use. As you're preparing, some people use Outline, some people use concept maps, some people use graphic organizers. But the first time you might say, I don't know which of those is going to work for me because I've never used any of them. So I would say, you know what, let's try them all. Let's kind of playground these. And it's a no thank you bite potentially. And you might say, you know what, I did it. It wasn't super helpful. I don't feel like it really added anything. And some people are like, I love this, right? So what I was going to provide as potentially a really targeted scaffold for one student would say, you know, why would someone use sentence stems? Why would someone use a graphic organizer? And people still push back on me to this day that says, I don't want students who, you know, have strong foundational literacy skills to be listening to a text. That's not for them. And one of the things I always say when I'm presenting is if I'm in like a fairly populated area, I'll always see like, is there a Target nearby? Is there a Walmart nearby? And I'll say, how many people here live within like 10 minutes of a Target? And they raise their hands. I said, how many of you have gotten delivery from Target? They raise their hands. I'm like, that wasn't meant for you. Right? That was meant for people who were not able to get transportation to Target, but we've accepted this as a universal accommodation. And now all of us take advantage of it. Why? Because it's more efficient. And if it's more efficient for a student to get their thoughts down because they have sentence stems and they don't have to use their cognitive load to come up with, how do I want to start saying this? Now they have more room to say, like, now this is what I really want to say, which is the same thing, which is true of like artificial intelligence right now, is that it can do some of like the low level cognitive work to save you to do what really matters, which is to get your personhood out there in a really beautifully creative way.
It's interesting that you bring up the issue of cognitive load. One question that I have is when it comes to UDL and you think about the three different areas, you know, multiple means of engagement, multiple means of representation, multiple means of action and expression. For a student who's not used to it, it can be overwhelming, right? And one of the thoughts, one of the regrets I had with writing the book Empower before was I wish I had done a chapter on a gradual release of responsibility approach to student choice, understanding that when you try to do it all at the beginning, it overwhelms some students. And so I'm curious, you know, how do you introduce something like UDL to students in a way that doesn't lead to cognitive overload if they're unfamiliar with these processes?
Yep. So UDL is really about how do we eliminate barriers that are excluding students and preventing them from learning at deeper levels, right? Mm-hmm. And what's paradoxically true is too many options actually creates really significant barriers. So there's this, somebody, he did a TED talk, his name's Barry Swartz. You know, it's the paradox of choice, and he's written a book by the same name, but his research is really focused on how much choice is too much choice. And based on the limits of working memory and cognitive load theory, the answer is anything more than six, you're going to have really decreased outcomes because of analysis paralysis, you know, cognitive overload. But the ideal number of choices is chunking choices, but never having more than two to four. And so when students are really overwhelmed, it's often because it's not designed appropriately. And so I always, you know, people will say some kids can't make choices. I'm like, nope, I don't believe it. Follow them to the cafeteria. Right. Yeah. The first thing they do is they open up the cooler. The only choice they have to make at the cooler is water, chocolate milk, regular milk. They choose one. Right. If we said everyone has to drink milk, that doesn't work because it excludes kids who are lactose intolerant. Right. Yeah. Then they move over to the taco bar. Right. And it's like, ooh, I'll take the meat. No, I'll take the chicken. There's two choices there. Right. Or the veggie. And so when we're designing, we're not saying, OK, everyone, you're going to have 15 choices for how you're going to learn this. And then there's 26 scaffolds that you can think about. And then here's a tic-tac-toe board with 9 choices to show what you know. Instead, it's more of like, how do we create a playlist that says like, okay, first let's make sure we all understand the goal. Now, the next thing is I want you to brainstorm what you already know about that. Do you want to do that by yourself, which you can just write down some notes, or would you rather do that with someone else? You know, and then we take some time, almost like a whole group rotation. Okay, so now that you understand what we're doing today, we're going to take some time to learn about it. And we have this amazing, profound text. It's digital. And so you might want to listen to it or translate it or, you know, so decide how you want to access this text, right? And so I think a lot of it is, how do we really think about what are the barriers? How do we kind of chunk and pace the decision-making and replicate the types of choices that students actually have in real life, which they are able to handle if we space them out. So when I tell people that, they're like, oh, thank goodness. Like, I thought I was going to be making choice boards with like 20 options. Yeah. And what I find is the more that we like really elevate student voice, the less we even need to come up with the options. And the more we can say, okay, listen, the goal here is to understand how characters interact in a text. And I'm going to allow you to choose a text, right? But ultimately, you're going to express and communicate how those character interactions drive the plot forward. How might you want to do that, right? Get in your groups and think about how you might want to do that. And think about in a way of like meaningful, like, you can like make this really amazing, highly edited YouTube video and put it out for anyone who's reading this book to like really understand this. You might choose a book that the middle school is reading right now, and you're going to create a lesson and then go down there and present to those students, right? And I think we're always trying to come up with it, but it's about choice and voice. And the voice might mean they become co-designers of what these options could be.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting as you share that, because when people first hear about UDL, when teachers hear about it, it can feel like, oh, this is another thing to add to my plate, right? And it really sounds like you're not talking about adding something to a teacher's plate. You're talking about getting teachers to see that you can provide the right kinds of things on the plate so that students can make it themselves, right? And that's a really different, and so I'm curious, like, how do you see UDL making the teacher's job easier than a more traditional view of like customizing the instruction during differentiation?
I really think that teachers are spending too much time creating options that are not construct relevant. So everyone's like, there's no time, there's no time, there's no time. And construct relevance is like, what really is it that all learners have to know and do? And then how can we design a flexible assessment to see who can do it already and who can't do it yet? And that allows us to maybe pull small groups and do some of that differentiation. But I think that in many ways, we're trying so hard to make things pretty and make things fun. And we're like really spending all of this time prepping, when in that example right there, I could say, all right, everyone, I just want to start off with something super informal, super diagnostic. I'm going to put out some protractors. You know, here's a huge like Zentangle shape. I want you to start figuring out how you measure these. I'm going to go around. I'm going to check in. You can ask anyone for whatever you need. And I just want to get a better sense of kind of how the variability is so that we can figure out like what are the barriers that we need to eliminate. And I could walk around and realize they all know how to do it. Right. And so it's like, okay, so let's move on. Right now we're going to talk about, and I think that so often it's like, we're like, okay, so I have to create this lesson on how to use a protractor, and I want the slides to be really pretty. And then, oh, I need different size protractors. And it, like, I think that in some ways we can say, how do we better use assessment to inform our understanding of the variability of our classroom, and then begin to say, okay, so now these are kind of the margins that I need to design for. And I know that, you know, there's going to be a mini lesson that is going to be necessary because some kids do not know how to use this protractor. And then I do exactly what you did. All right, everyone, tomorrow's class, I'm going to start off with a 15-minute workshop. So I want you to really think about what we did yesterday. And if I checked in with you and said that's not quite it, you're going to be really frustrated as we move on. So why don't you come over here today? And maybe you already know how, but you just love the fact that I give you mints to bribe you to come over here. And that's fine too, right? Whatever it happens to be. But like, I think that before doing that, people will spend hours and hours and hours, as opposed to saying like, what really do students need as opportunities so that they can do this work? And so there's so much intersection there with just like the work of PLC, or, you know, professional learning teams, of like, what really is it that kids have to know and do? How do we know if they can do it? And then what are we going to design if they can, versus what are we going to design if they can't, knowing that in the same room, you probably have people in both groups.
So it's interesting. You bring up a little bit there, the role of leaders. You alluded to it. And I know in your new book, In Support of Students, A Leader's Guide to Equitable MTSS, you get into this idea of multi-tiered systems, of an equity-based approach, of bringing in those ideas of UDL. And I'm curious if you could kind of speak to what this looks like at the school-wide level, and maybe what the role of a leader would be in terms of setting these systems up.
Sure. So, you know, the foundation of MTSS, the foundation of RTI before MTSS, was that we include all learners in a general education classroom, a tier one environment with their peers. That is the vision, knowing that some students will need more than that. But the foundation is really about how do we make a general education classroom truly the least restrictive environment for all learners. And a lot of people think that MTSS is simply just the continuum of supports, which is like, we have tier one, where we want everyone to be a part of, which they're not yet. Then we're gonna have tier two, which is additional supplemental support for small groups of students who might need some intervention, might need some remediation of skills, might need some acceleration. And then we have this tier three. And a lot of people think that that is a multi-tiered system of support. That is the multi-tiers, and the system of support is everything around it that allows it to function as it should, which is teacher professional development, which is high quality instructional materials, which is a schedule that allows for supplemental support for students, which is work on how leaders allocate resources and how we involve families. So the system of support is literally everything that we're doing in a system, so that all students can be included in tier one. And we also have data that tells us when some students will need more than that. And the language used federally is you have to supplement, not supplant, which means that you should never pull a student out of a tier one opportunity to provide them with tier two or tier three support. And yet in some cases, we don't have any other choice, because we don't have the staff to do it. We don't have the curriculum to do it. We don't have the schedule to do it. We don't have the parent support to do it. So all of those drivers are what creates a multi-tiered system of support. So if you think about the acronym MTSS, just snap it in half, right? The MT is a lot of what we remember about those response to intervention models, right? Some students are gonna need more support. So my amazing daughter, she is included in all of her seventh grade classes. Her is a co-taught class like that you were in. And then she also, in addition, receives Wilson Reading every day. She also, in addition, is in a small group for speech and language. And people say, well, what does she miss? She doesn't miss anything, because a lot of the services are pushed into a co-taught class. And there's a block in the schedule for every student, which sometimes is called like an intervention or enrichment block. Her district calls it a what I need block. And that if students need something in their schedule for tier two or tier three, they can get that without having to miss anything, right? And so when people hear about that, they're like, well, that would be great, but like, our staff doesn't have the training to be that inclusive of kids who have complex needs, or my curriculum isn't flexible enough for that, or I don't even have enough desks in my classroom. Those are all the barriers that we have to eliminate so that teachers feel prepared to meet the needs of students. And that means they know how to universally design. They have time to figure out the barriers together and eliminate them. And then they have the more technical tools to do that. So what can leaders do? Leaders can really think about who is currently being included in really meaningful learning experiences where they have lots of options and choices for personalization, for agency, for deeper learning. And then when you're recognizing the students who are not, we have to ask ourselves, well, what are the potential barriers? Why aren't they included in those experiences? And that's when you start saying, well, one reason is we simply don't have a schedule that would allow kids to get the service that have to be provided legally. And that. Another thing is our teachers who are general education teachers don't feel prepared to do that. And therefore, if I placed a student there, the environment would be too restrictive and legally I can't do that. I need parents to understand this work. So I think that it's just a recognition of just as there can be barriers in lesson design that prevent kids from being successful, there can be barriers in schools and districts that prevent us from building the type of system that allows us to do this for kids.
Final question. If people are interested in UDL, so not even thinking about NTSS, just thinking UDL in general, what are some good first steps in terms of connecting with you? What would you recommend in terms of just getting started?
You know, I would say that the first step is just learning more about what universal design for learning actually is. There's a lot of misconception that it's the same thing as differentiated instruction, that it's some like new fad, right? It is a framework that has been around for, you know, almost four decades. It's written into the United Nations. It's in the Every Student Succeeds Act. This is not a fad. This is not about lowering expectations, but we'll go, you know, there's multiple means of representation to learn about it. You could read books, you could listen to podcasts, you could go online and find some videos, but ultimately it's about the first step is really understanding what is universal design for learning. A lot of people go, oh, I'm already doing that. I'm like, well, like to say that you're universally designing when not every one of your students is learning at really high levels, it just doesn't match, right? Because if we have eliminated all the barriers, then every kid is engaged, every kid is learning, and every kid is included, and we're not there yet. So I think that it's safe to say I'm using some of these strategies and I'm beginning to eliminate some of these barriers for some kids, but this is life's work to really try to get to know kids, the barriers that they're facing, the barriers within our own design, and to continually commit to learning. So it starts with just what is universal design for learning? Feel free to reach out to me. I'm very easy to find in the cyber world. And, you know, from there, maybe grabbing a team at a school and say, like, let's lean into this together and let's start talking about what are some of the barriers here that are preventing students from being successful.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. I have enjoyed this interview and it's been a blast to just talk about these topics with you.
It was absolutely lovely. Let's do it again someday.
All right, well, there you have it. That was Katie Novak talking about this idea of universal design for learning, how we make it happen, how we make it feasible. If you enjoyed this podcast, would you do me a favor and leave a review on Apple Podcast or Spotify or Stitcher or wherever it is that you get your podcast? And would you think about maybe telling a colleague or a friend about this podcast as well? Word of mouth is one of the best ways for people to find out about it. With that said, thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day and go out and make something awesome.